Is this the way it begins? Massive floods, perhaps soaring up into more than $5 billion by the time it's all over in damage throughout the entire Midwest of the United States. The South burns up in a heat wave. There's a drought from southern Virginia to north and South Carolina. The United States is virtually divided into two segments, with truckers, railways, and all types of goods and services unable to flow back and forth without massive detours. Factories from Detroit to Los Angeles are bereft of the parts they need. Many, many days delay, and sometimes a week and more, of orders being unfulfilled, so that the eventual spin-off in cost to an already weak, staggering economy may really be $10 to $15 billion. At a very time when the weakest president in the history of the United States, in many ways, is adding to the tax burden of Americans. Is this the way it begins? A war in the Balkans, in a town called, or a city called Sarajevo, where Europeans are turning their backs as tens of thousands of Muslims are being systematically exterminated in torture camps reminiscent of Hitler's death camps in World War II, where wretched refugees struggle amidst gunfire and exploding mortar shells to get to the places where a ruptured pipe has given them the only source of water in their city, and where people who attend the funerals of their loved ones recently maimed and blasted to death in a mortar barrage are themselves killed live on camera as the heroes in the hills lob mortar shells at individuals outside of Sarajevo attending a funeral ceremony. If you had been alive in 1920, how in the world could you have predicted that by 1940, Kaiser Wilhelm would have been gone, World War I, of course, long since over, World War II would be raging in Britain and all of Europe, Hitler would be attacking Russia, the United States would be sitting on its hands on the sidelines screaming protectionism and isolationism, and yet the world would be convulsing in what, again, was another round of world war. I was alive in 1940 and 1941 when I remember the news broadcast being interrupted when I was helping my mother do the washing, that some place called Pearl Harbor had been bombed. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know whether Pearl Harbor was somewhere just offshore Portland, Oregon, or whether it was down off Long Beach Harbor, or just where it was. I soon found out, because I had to learn my geography during World War II. Who could have guessed, even at that time, that in 5 short years the world would be ushered upon the nuclear age, that more than 70 million people would lay dead, that nations would be literally destroyed, their major cities only hulks and empty burnt shards of what they used to be, millions upon millions of people dead, starving to death, disease rampant, the coldest winter in the history of Europe in 1946, and that suddenly the Cold War would begin and Russia would clamp down what Sir Winston Churchill called an iron curtain across all of Eastern Europe. And in a very few short years following the Berlin airlift, the Russians would build a wall dividing Berlin. If you had lived in those days, who could have guessed that by the time in which we live today, the Soviet Empire would have collapsed? The United States would once again have warm relations, albeit tempered somewhat by what happened in Tiananmen Square and their concern over civil rights and human rights and their favored trade status as a nation, but again, relations with communist China. Who could have guessed in 1945 that the greatest superpowers in the world beside the United States would be Germany and Japan? Could anyone have guessed? Could anyone have foretold? Could anyone have spelled out in step-by-step sequence some of the great events to take place in this world, in the world in which we live right now today? Yes, someone did. Not all of it in detail, but the overall trends. When I was a young boy, my father, Herbert W. Armstrong, up in Eugene, Oregon, from his vantage point after America was suddenly brought into the war following the attack at Pearl Harbor, in looking at what was happening in North Africa and all over the Middle East and Europe, for that matter, knowing that all of the Scandinavian countries had been swallowed up by Hitler, that he had sent his panzer divisions through Belgium around the famed Maginot Line and come crashing into France, that France had only lasted a matter of a very few weeks, and that Hitler had swallowed up all of Europe, was now attacking the Soviet Union, and that his tanks were at the gates of Moscow, that North Africa had fallen, and hundreds of thousands of Italians and German soldiers were within sight and sound of Alexandria, Egypt. And that was like a vast pincers movement moving with the Japanese over the roof of the world of the Himalayas, having already bombed Rangoon and seemingly ready to launch an all-out attack through Burma against India. My father predicted that if the Axis powers met in the Middle East, he felt Pope Pius XII was the final great false religious leader. He felt that Mussolini, later Hitler, revised his estimate and wrote Hitler, was the beast of biblical prophecy. He felt that if that occurred, and Hitler and the Japanese linked up in the Middle East, that the Pope would move from Rome to Jerusalem, the so-called birthplace of the church, and that that would be the imposition of the abomination of desolation, and that the second coming of Christ would only be a matter of a very few years away. We had just come out in the 1930s of a terrible cycle of drought. We were just barely staggering out of, and war production caused most of that, one of the great global depressions of all time. That depression had led to destabilization of governments all over Europe and the rise of despotism and dictators in Spain, Italy, Portugal, many other nations who had lesser dictators, of which you learn little in history, including Hungary and including Bulgaria, and including some of the nations of the present-day Yugoslavia that are fragmenting, and especially in Germany itself. And so the solution for these people, when the United States was coming up with things like the Townsend Plan and Social Security and CCC programs to try to put millions of Americans back to work, the solution for those nations was to turn to a strong man, a dictator, to bring order from all the fractious political parties, from all the riots and demonstrations, and to give people relief, because people were hungry, they were not fed, they were not clothed, they didn't have a job. Here we are at a time when everyone seems to say, peace, peace, when there is no peace. We are living in a time when we think the United States is not that bad off. Apparently, a little bit of a bottoming out of the recession is occurring, and all the happy noises were being made by the new administration, until the G7 met in Tokyo, and some of the analysts got a hold of the empty words that were spoken and the real trends and curves in all of the nations involved, when they documented in Time magazine that the seven leaders who met there are the weakest leaders perhaps in all time when you consider them all together. That practically within weeks, Keiichi Miyazawa may be no more the leader of Japan. That in a matter of only a year or two, Helmut Kohl may be gone. That Majors is looked upon as a very weak leader and may be gone very quickly. That Clinton surely is only a one-term president. I brought with me only a fraction of the magazines with some fantastic head lead articles on them that talk about some of the conditions in the world and in the United States that I want to go over very, very briefly. I simply cannot take the time to read more than one or two quick quotations. But before I do that, I want to turn to Matthew, the 24th chapter, to refresh our memory of what Jesus Christ said would characterize the time prior to God's intervention in human affairs. His disciples asked him what he meant when he talked about a time of terrible destruction where not one great stone would be left atop another in Jerusalem. And he said, take heed that no man deceive you. Verse 4. Many shall come in my name, saying, I'm the Christ, and shall deceive many. And you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. There are wars raging in 15 different nations today. We hear practically nothing of what's happening in Azerbaijan, in Soviet Georgia, in the Crimea, in Russia itself, in North Africa. We do hear of Bosnia-Herzegovina. We hear very little in some of the other cases like Chad and other nations such as South Africa experiencing its daily mayhem and murder. We hear very little about SWAPO and some of the other organizations in what used to be Southwest Africa and over in Mozambique, where a Marxist government took charge. We hear very little about some of the upsets, the political movements, and the underground cells that are operating, mostly sponsored by Cuba, throughout Central and South America. Instead, we hear of some of the most critically important and vital issues to the American public, whether or not gays are going to be admitted into the military under the don't tell, don't ask rule or not. We know what is important in our wonderful country. Jesus said, "You shall hear of wars and rumors of wars." But this is a message to his disciples. The people who were involved in wars have every reason to be troubled. There's been no such thing as a small war to the person who was involved in it. If it was only a war that had the limits of a county involved, if you're being shot at, it's the biggest war you've got right then. But he is telling his disciples, "See that you be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. Nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom," different kinds of governments, different kinds of political structures, "against kingdom, and there shall be famines." Have you heard of anything called a famine in a place called Somalia? Have you heard of a famine in Niger or Chad or Dahomey? Have you heard of famines throughout the North African Sub-Sahara belt? Have you heard of famines in other countries where people are starving and don't have enough to eat? Many of the refugees trying to pour into the United States shores are not necessarily political refugees seeking asylum. They are economic refugees because there is no work, not enough food and clothing and shelter in the nation from whence they came. There shall be famines. Have you heard about the price of everything from beef, because the corn and the wheat feeds the cattle, to chicken, to all of the food grains and to your cereals and everything else that will be going up markedly in the supermarkets in the weeks and the months ahead? Have you heard what Daniel Moynihan said when he was asked, "How will the government come to the aid of all of these stricken farmers by their hundreds of thousands and millions all the way from clear up in Minnesota down eventually to Louisiana when the Mississippi is through ravaging the whole midsection of the United States?" And they were asking just yesterday, "I want to know, when can I have my check?" Well, tell them it'll be there within 1 week after they fill out the forms. Moynihan said, "Well, we can always borrow more for something like that." So at the very time when many Americans were taking heart and thinking, well, even if there is an energy tax, even if there is the heaviest tax increase in the history of the nation, maybe if we all chip in, we can do something about this deficit. Maybe we can put this economy back on its feet. And all of a sudden, it began to rain. And day after day after day after day, I got up in the morning and went out in my backyard and I watched those clouds hurrying to the north. And I felt this tremendous heat and humidity on my face. And I realized the Gulf was just evaporating water and just pouring it in the air up into the midsection of the United States, where it was meeting a cold trough that was just sitting there in a stable front, going nowhere, day after day and week after week, and it wasn't moving, and it was raining, raining, raining in Iowa, Nebraska, Illinois, Indiana, North and South Dakota, and all the way down to the Tennessee Valley, and all the way along the Mississippi Valley. And it just kept on and on and on, and it's still doing it today. And so for the first time in our history, the capital of a state, a great major national city, Des Moines, was completely shut down. Even its downtown streets flooded, its major water treatment plant shut down, and the president cut short his vacation, which he shouldn't have even stopped for one day in an attempt to take a vacation with what was going on in his own country. But somebody told him, "You better get back there and look at it." And they said he was visibly shaken and moved when they took him by helicopter over Des Moines and some of the areas that were lying under all of these hundreds of feet, I suppose, in some cases, of water. But it spreads out for hundreds of miles all over the Midwest. I haven't heard yet whether that last remaining bridge in more than a 100-mile segment has given way, but they were trying to save it with levees and truckers all over the United States who were going back and forth day and night. The bridge is, somebody is signaling me, now gone. That means they've got to go way north, way south. The railways are not running. The barge traffic is stopped. Barge traffic up and down the Mississippi River is one of the absolute lifelines of the national economy, moving all kinds of major things to ports of the world, and was how we were able to compete with things like the Kiel Canal and the Rhine River and Amsterdam and Rotterdam and all the production of Europe and the Ruhr Valley. In Amos 4 and verse 8, it reminds me of this scripture when I look at what is happening today in our beloved United States of America. I thought of it on the way over here because God showed that He was going to send a time of famine and drought, but also that there would be floods and there would be a complete disparity between the amount of water available in one place and another. He said, and I'll begin reading up to that in verse 6 of Amos, the fourth chapter. I also have given you cleanness of teeth in all your cities. That's eventually. That means cleanness of teeth because the teeth are dry and there's been no food, no meat, no reason to ask for a toothpick. In all your cities, and want of bread in all your places. Yet you have not returned unto me, says the Eternal. Also I've withholden the rain from you when there were yet 3 months to the harvest, and I caused it to rain upon one city, and caused it not to rain upon another city. One piece was rained upon, Iowa and the states that I've mentioned, and the piece whereupon it rained not withered, North and South Carolina, Virginia, and the Atlantic seaboard. So two or three cities wandered into one city to drink water, but they were not satisfied. Yet have you not returned unto me, says the Eternal. I have smitten you with blasting and mildew, that's crop damage, that's stem rust and root rot and so on. When your gardens and your vineyards and your fig trees and your olive trees increased, the palmer worm devoured them, and yet you have not returned unto me. I have sent among you the pestilence after the manner of Egypt. Your young men have I slain with a sword, and have taken away your horses. And I have made the stink of your camps to come up into your nostrils, yet you have not returned unto me, says the Eternal. Christ said, there shall be famines. There are, there have been, we could argue there have always been famines, but there shall be far worse before it's all over. Is this the way it begins? Does it begin by seemingly little things here and there? Could anyone who was alive in 1914 have said that when some imbecile jumped up on the running board of an open touring vehicle and sent bullets into the crown prince or the heir apparent of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, that it would eventually widen a war between the Serbs, is that a familiar term, and the Austrians, and that that would eventually erupt into World War II and cause that enormous amount of loss of life and destruction? But it did. And for many people, a seemingly benign, rather, situation, because they couldn't understand how in the world that could trigger, like a domino effect, nation after nation getting involved. There shall be famines and pestilences. Pestilences, that's disease epidemics. Now, what is rapidly becoming the biggest killer of Americans, even superseding such things as heart disease and emphysema, superseding long since automobile accidents, becoming one of the major causes of death in the United States? AIDS. AIDS. Brought upon mankind by homosexuals, by promiscuity, and by drug addicts sharing dirty needles. Time Magazine special report, sex for sale, an alarming boom in prostitution, debases the women and children of the world. Newsweek magazine, taming the AIDS virus. New research suggests HIV is an old virus that turned deadly. Can scientists make it less lethal? Death Wish, you shall see false Christs and false prophets, and they shall deceive many. The so-called wacko from Waco, who had his own little version of Armageddon, and there are others out there just like him. Newsweek, gays under fire. And all the demonstrations, and in the last week or so, very large marches and demonstrations in many cities across the country. The United States, terror hits home. The Twin Trade Towers bombed by radical Islamic fundamentalists, and those same Islamic fundamentalists, not all of them tied to the Sheikh, who is now about to be deported back to Egypt, where they want him and probably will hang him or stone him to death, but not all of them are adherents to the teaching of this one blind Sheikh. who is a refugee, an escapee from Egyptian justice. There are people all over the United States. There are millions of them. There is a mosque right up here off Reeks Road in Tyler, Texas. There are Islamic people all over the United States. And though the United States has only about 4.7% of the population of the world, the United States absorbs more than 50% of the refugees of the world. And those refugees are not anymore emigres from the Irish potato famine. They are not emigres who came here from Europe, from Germany. They are not Jews. They are not people who have talents and abilities who are ready and willing to go to work. They are predominantly people from the third world who are illiterate and unskilled and cannot find jobs, and many of them end up living with relatives on American welfare. 60% of the ones arrested in the Los Angeles riots following the Rodney King debacle were illegal immigrants, and they were burning down Los Angeles because of their irk over the United States' lack of civil rights. But they were illegal immigrants, and they were demonstrating and rioting and burning down their neighborhood. What you and your children should know is what the Clinton appointee, who is a black lady, for Surgeon General, now facing confirmation and all kinds of problems involving financial skullduggery, apparently, would like to teach our children. She wants information about condoms and safe sex to be taught all the way down to the first grade in kindergarten. Here is Newsweek magazine, what you and your children should know, safe sex. Of course, they're trying to tell people that the little tiny microscopic holes that exist in condoms are much too large to prevent viruses, which will fall through a little mesh if you could, you know, form one, that are much smaller than bacteria, and that they can actually, but that is not safe. And so they're trying to educate people about that because they know people are going to be promiscuous, so let's educate them. Chilling headline, Newsweek magazine. Here is a very sick man. He's already lost much of his hair. He is pallid. He is weak. He's lost a lot of weight. He is a physician. He is a doctor. There are doctors all over the country. And sometimes it's not because they're homosexual. Sometimes it's because they treated someone and they contracted AIDS because of their profession. When you go to get your teeth cleaned anymore, notice very carefully how the dental technician will wear rubber gloves and probably a plastic mask and be a whole lot more careful than she used to be. Newsweek. Child abuse all over the United States. A court found the Souzas guilty of molesting their own grandchildren. The United States of America, the land of the free, the home of the brave. Let me give you an indication of what it's costing you and me when all of these poor, and you have to feel sorry for them, starving refugees who have coughed up enormous amounts of money to, like Chinese mafia, thousands of dollars to come to the United States, being aboard a ship crammed in a hold where they're not fed enough for about 5 solid weeks, and then end up, the minute the ship is in sight of the harbor, jumping overboard, some of them dying, the rest of them now under detention. Immigration costs us over $45 billion. With a crack-up of the grotesquely named Golden Ventures, says a conservative chronicle off the coast of New York, the full horror of the reality of illegal immigration may at last be breaking through the fog of propaganda about it. Packed into the stinking holds of the vessel, fed 2 bowls of rotten rice a day for 5 months. I said 5 weeks. It was 5 months they were aboard that ship. Extorted for some $20,000. They gave up everything they ever owned but the ragged clothes on their backs to some rotten, filthy gangsters in a third world country. 296 Chinese nationals finally jumped and swam for their lives when the ship limped into sight of land. 8 of them drowned or died of hypothermia. 5 remain hospitalized. 6 disappeared into the bottomless jungle of the Big Apple. The captain and crew of the slave ship are in custody for smuggling. And 276 of their slaves, and that's what it is, now sit in American jails awaiting the tender ministrations of the immigration bureaucracy. If you liked the African slave trade, you ought to love illegal immigration. But the Golden Venture is not unique. Last week, 2 fishing boats with another 300 illegals from China were nabbed in San Francisco. Last month, the Coast Guard seized a ship in San Diego Harbor with 193 illegals. And these are merely the ones mentioned in recent news reports. Joan Lund of the Chinese Staff and Workers Association says this is a modern-day slave trade. The New York Times interviewed one of the Chinese illegals, and he said, "I regret coming," says Hua Zhen. "I feel like I was tricked. Everybody told me that life in America was wonderful, that everybody in America has a big house and a big car." What a lie. And Hua said he had to cough up no less than $27,000 to be able to endure a 52-day voyage from China to Mexico, and then was told he had to walk across the border. Now in New Jersey, he's living with Chinese relatives. He still has not found work, and he says he's sorry he ever left. That ought to tell us something about Chinese communism. The man is in America. He's in New Jersey, and he's awfully sorry he came. Give us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shores. Send these. Send them to me. I lift my lamp above the tideless sea. So it says to that effect. And here is a picture of the sad lady holding up her skirts with the ships besieging her and coming ashore on the island where the Statue of Liberty is in New York Harbor. Only a little bit of a potpourri of what we see happening all around us. Is this how it will begin? Will it begin so monumentally, so strikingly, so suddenly, and so shockingly that everyone will immediately say, it's the beginning of the Great Tribulation? Is that the way World War I began? Is that the way World War II began? Is the Great Tribulation something you find in a scripture in the Bible? Or is it the combination of hundreds of events and all kinds of inputs from nations all over the world, and most especially the implosion morally, economically, in every other way of the nation upon whom that great time of trouble is predicted to come? How will it begin? What did Jesus say? He said it will begin with false Christs and false prophets. There have always been those, but there certainly is a tremendous upsurge in it right now today, and tremendous things that have happened in that field, which has really rendered most television evangelists extremely unpopular. In prison, sued, exposed. But you know, in Daniel 12 and verse 7 is a very frightening scripture. If you'll turn to that, I'm going to keep my place in Matthew 24 and turn to Daniel 12 and verse 7. In looking at God's church for a minute, what has happened in the last 15 years in God's church? It says, when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people. The man clothed in linen was upon the waters of the river, and when he held up his right hand and his left hand unto heaven, and swear by him that liveth forever and ever, that it shall be, that is the duration of this time of trouble, for a year and 2 years and a half a year, 3.5 years, a time times and a half time. And when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all these things shall be accomplished or finished. I heard, but I didn't understand. And I said, O my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? He said, go thy way, Daniel, for these words are closed up and sealed until the time of the end. And then they are to be opened, and then they are to be understood. Many shall be purified and made white and tried. That is the trial of the Christian life. That is the cuts and kicks and bruises, the persecutions, the temptations that a Christian must overcome. But the wicked shall do wickedly with both hands greedily. Their feet run to do evil. The wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand. Why has understanding disappeared from the largest body of Sabbath keepers in the United States outside of the Seventh-day Adventist Church? Why has understanding of biblical prophecy, understanding of the signs of the times, been negated, ignored, neglected, never even apparently mentioned among these people on a massive television effort all across our land? Why is it that people such as a Ross Perot or a Rush Limbaugh, these are political or commentators who are political commentators, who are talking about what's wrong with America, when you turn on a television program and hear about family, or joy, or some other little piece of pablum about the same way that you hear when you're flipping around the channels on a Sunday morning and listening to these fellows up there talking about the same subject, as if they didn't even know that there was a real world going by out there where every other car on the freeway has a gun. As if they didn't know what's happening in the world around them, they stand up there and pontificate about a lot of spiritual ideas and empty theories and seemingly ignore what is happening in the world. The wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. God has given understanding to His church. Wars and rumors of wars, the war in the Gulf, the strike on Baghdad's military intelligence buildings, the wars in Bosnia-Herzegovina, and all the others that I mentioned to you. Yet, paradoxically, at this very time, everybody is saying, as it says in Jeremiah 8 and verse 11, peace, peace, when there is no peace. Is it true that the United States is the world's only remaining superpower? There are no more tigers in the world. There are no more enemies out there. And so the United States is imploding. It is turning inward. Because of a desperately bankrupt economy, we are cutting back on military and defense spending, closing down dozens of bases, canceling major defense contracts, bringing U.S. soldiers home from abroad, reducing the size of the U.S. military. Thinking now in Congress is that maybe we will cancel future aircraft carriers. The United States is the world's only remaining superpower. That sounds like the name of a song that is calculated to put us to sleep, a lulling song of slumber. But in the Ukraine and Russia, they're dividing up the Russian fleet. And in Japan, skullduggery is afoot. This is the title of a shocking, frightening book, The Coming War with Japan. I would like to read to you just one small segment. No great power can tolerate a situation in which the very lifeblood of its society and economy are in the hands of another power, another nation, let alone a nation that has interests fundamentally opposed to its own. Japan can never be secure, nor in control of its own destiny, until it controls the sources of its mineral supplies and the transportation routes that carry those supplies to Japan. Nor can it guarantee its prosperity until it can guarantee access to markets for its exports and security for its investments. While the United States had strategic reasons for supporting Japan, and while Japan was a relatively weak player on the international scene, this situation was tolerable. But with today's dramatically changed strategic situation, the emergence of Japan as an economic superpower, Japan will inevitably need to control the elements of its own survival. How many years ago was it when I first told the American public over and over again, you will see, eventually, the Japanese putting to sea a nuclear-powered, nuclear-armed navy, which will rival that of the United States and eventually supersede it? How many years ago have I talked about the Straits of Malacca and Singapore? Have I talked about far-off Chile and the potash route? Have I talked about the source of oil through the Straits of Hormuz? Have I talked about the Japanese economy being like a giant heart with extended blood and arterial vessels lying there completely exposed, able to be severed by some other power at its whim? No nation can control its destiny without a military force equal to its needs. During the Cold War, the U.S. provided Japan with sufficient benign force, so Japan did not need to develop its own military power. It would be a surprise, however, today to learn that Japan spends more money on defense than China, than Germany, than Britain, or than France, because it spends a tiny percentage of its GNP. But its GNP is so gigantic that that little percentage represents more than the German or the British defense budget. Whether Japan will rearm is no longer the question. The question is to what extent and to what end. In considering Japan's future strategy, attention is drawn to the first U.S.-Japanese war. As in World War II, if for different reasons, Singapore must be the focus of Japanese strategy. If an enemy were to seize Singapore and its Malaccan Straits, Japan would be strangled. The bulk of Japan's oil, as well as other mineral supplies, passes through those narrow straits. Japan cannot help but be aware of this fact, nor can it avoid the conclusion that the one power that could close Malacca is a power with the motive for doing so. What brought about tension between the Japan and the United States and the so-called ABCD powers prior to World War II? Following the Mukden Incident in 1924 and the Japanese invasion of China and the Japanese attempt to, in their justification for their presence in China, prevent China from being swallowed up by communism, that's the way they justified it. Roosevelt decided, in concert with the Dutch, the British, and all of the other people that were involved, not to a great degree any other powers but the United States, in the Indonesian area of the Southeast Asian area, the islands of Indonesia, and of course American interest in the Philippines, decided to clamp down embargoes on the Japanese. We are now hearing strident cries inside the American Congress for protectionism measures. We've been hearing it for months and months and years and years. And because we are unable to compete, and the Japanese and some of their industrial leaders have written books, America should say no to Japan, like the chairman of the Sony Corporation did. And this is a part of the hallmark of their thinking in their government today, that Japan should stand up to the United States, that we do not understand Japanese philosophy. We don't understand the vertical cartels. We don't understand the way their companies recruit all the way from high school and the loyalty of a Japanese worker who decides to go to work for a company for the rest of his remainder of his natural life, and that he will only take vacations as that company allows him to do in company-owned hotels, spending Japanese money in Japanese establishments and coming back to Japan. When I learned that a golf course I could take you to in about a 45-minute drive was purchased by the Japanese up along I-20 and was completely rebuilt with a brand new 18 holes, and that they were going to fly Japanese businessmen and their wives over to this part of East Texas because they could do so more cheaply and give them a golf vacation than those same people could play golf in Japan. Because a membership in a country club in Japan is anywhere from $1 to $5 million, and one round of golf costs $5,000. And so they could actually pay JAL to bring them to San Francisco and American Airlines to bring them all the way to Tyler and take them up here to a place called Garden Valley and let them play golf and go home and save money while they're doing it. Something must be wrong when things like that can occur. The Japanese are going to eventually go to war against the United States because we are insisting that they, quote, open their markets. The Japanese don't want our inferior goods. The Japanese don't want to buy our products at the incredible amount of money they would have to spend because our labor force has struck and joined labor unions and gotten to the place that we're some of the best paid people in the world. And now the Germans are following our same mistakes. And the Germans are now, in West Germany especially, even further along than we are. And actually, the average West German worker makes more money than the average American worker. And the government subsidies in West Germany are such that the German economic bubble is soon going to burst. So Japan cannot help but be aware of the fact that the Straits of Malacca are strategic. Japan must plan for the worst case, as must all great powers. And that means they must take steps to ensure the United States, if we got to the point of a trade war, if we got to the point of freezing of assets, trade embargoes, and then sanctions, and we tried to close down routes of supply to bring Japan to its knees and make it conform to United States demands for free trade, they must take steps to ensure the United States does not close the Straits of Malacca or any other area where their ships need to have access. And so you know what Japan has done? They have built up the world's most formidable ASW warfare navy that is afloat today. Some of them are depicted below on the cover of this book. Not a one of our cruise missiles or our smart bombs could have been going down ventilator shafts and inside hangar doors in the Gulf War if the Japanese had not supplied us with the high-tech computer chips and the guidance systems for some of our military weapons. The Japanese have contributed very heavily to American defense. One does not have to argue that Japan is preparing for war. It is sufficient to note that Japan would be insane not to prepare for war. Do you know that you could go to the Pentagon and they could usher you in to that particular room where the war plans files are kept, and you could see and read the contingency plans for war with Canada? Think I'm lying to you? You could read the contingency plans for a war between the United States and Great Britain. Don't you know that there are contingency plans in the intelligence organizations of every nation for war with any other nation, depending upon certain sets of circumstances? And they just sit there in the file gathering dust, and they'll be brought out and studied and revised if and when they're ever needed. But there have been serious-minded people at the very highest echelons in the defense community and in the intelligence community who have studied for years what might happen if the United States had to go to war against Great Britain, as shocking as that may sound. So let's be aware, let's be wise, and let's understand that the Japanese are going to change their constitution, that a new Japanese government is going to come in, which is going to elevate their new emperor and empress to once again the status of a god, that the Japanese are going to turn into a militaristic government, and the people who will force them to do so are the people who gather on the mall in Washington and scream, "We want more." Let's talk about that for a minute. Our nation is turning inward. Me, my, I want my job. Better yet, give me money. Forget the job. Give me a minimum wage, no matter how slovenly, how lazily, slowly, and haphazardly I work, quote-unquote. Give me guaranteed health care, diagnosis, pharmaceuticals, and hospitalization, and let somebody else pay for it. Give me. I want mine. The homosexuals cry out, "I want mine." The feminists cry out, "I want my way." The minorities cry out, "I want mine. I want to right every wrong. I want everybody to be given an equal share. I want to punish and rob from the rich and distribute equally to the poor," the way the communists and the Marxists and Leninists proposed in the greatest collapse in the history of any attempt at governing a nation, as the Soviet Union has demonstrated. Meanwhile, as the United States shoulders the burden for all of these massive costs, because we are a nation that is no longer imbued with a great dynamic purpose or a great transcendental cause toward which our people dynamically work. We are people who are relaxing. We want our slice. We want our piece of the pie. We want our day in the sun. We want everything that is good and wonderful for us. We go out and play the lottery, and we spend hundreds of millions of dollars, and people who are playing it are the people who can least afford it, and stopping by the little country stores and buying lottery tickets until there are hundreds of millions of dollars, and every American practically has been turned into a gambler and hoping that they will be struck by lightning and make about 17 or 20 or 50 million dollars, take theirs and run, get away, and have the good life. Well, let's take a look at what God says about some of this. I've read before, they declare their sin as Sodom, they hide it not, but it's particularly irritating to me that when I will sit over here in the TV studio and do a program right from God's Word on the terrible sin of homosexuality and sodomy, that I will be blocked from the airwaves by Superstation WGN, that I will be blocked from the airwaves by the satellite network in Canada, or they will bleep me out when I say things right out of the Word of God that homosexuality is a sin. They won't allow you to say that in public anymore. You can still say it in churches, but you can't say it over their radio or television stations. You can only say it in audiences such as this. How many nations have nuclear arsenals? The United States, Russia, France, China, Georgia, the Ukraine, England, Israel, Egypt, South Africa, and probably Brazil, Bangladesh, North Korea, and Germany. And there are others, quote, waiting in the wings to join the so-called nuclear club. More than 101 nuclear reactors have been humming away in Japan since the late 1950s. Every one of those produced plutonium as a byproduct. We know that Americans, I should say few Americans know, that Japan, let me ask you this, don't give me a showing of hands, I just want to know how many of you just think mentally as I ask, how many of you know that Japan has launched satellites, that Japan has a space program, that Japan has launched communications and, therefore, probably other types of satellites which may be parked over major American cities and viewing what's going on below and have been in space for quite a period of time. You don't know that, do you? Most of you don't even know that. Why don't you know that? Because that's not something the media tells you. That's not what sells newspapers and magazines. But it's true. How many of you know that the Japanese have been building the F-15 Eagle and even making their own improvements on it, and that the F-15s they have are a slight edge superior to those that we have? And they're doing so under a piece of paper in a file drawer somewhere, but not a single one of the components or parts is shipped over there from the United States or from our factories, but are all made from the least little valve, nut, or bolt, or any other component part in the nation of Japan. Double and a half supersonic F-15 Eagles that can rotate off the end of a runway and be to 60,000 feet in about 2 minutes. And the Japanese, I showed you a picture on Watch Magazine of them flying in formation with the rising sun of Japan painted on the nacelle, and those aircraft were made all the way from the ground up in Japan. America, while all of these things are happening abroad, is listening to a swan song that we are the only remaining superpower. Russia has, for all practical purposes, been defeated. We have no one to fear. We have no worries. Let's get about the business of, quote, growing the economy, end quote. And that seems to be where we are. I want you to turn to a prophecy, and we will deal with this and see whether or not we can trust the Word of God. In the 10th chapter of the book of Isaiah is a prophecy pronounced many, many years ago about what would happen to the nation of Israel, the people identified as Israel. Verse 5, O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger, and the staff in their hand is mine indignation. I will send him against an hypocritical nation, and against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge, to take the spoil, to take the prey, and to tread them down like the mire of the streets. Howbeit he meaneth not so, neither doth his heart think so. Interesting language. He's going to do it, but he doesn't really believe, he's not really planning, he wouldn't really think that he could do it. But it is in his heart, it's a part of his nature, to destroy and cut off nations, not a few. This is talking about a war-making nation of people whose very nature is to go to war. Some of the old ancient places and names are then mentioned. And then he says, verse 12, Wherefore it shall come to pass that when the Lord has performed his whole work upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks. For he saith, By the strength of my hand I have done it, and by my wisdom. For I am prudent, and remove the bounds of the people, and have robbed their treasures, and I put down the inhabitants like a valiant man. And my hand is found as a nest of riches of the people. As one gathers eggs that are left, have I gathered all the earth, and there was none that moved the wing, or opened the mouth, or peeped. And God says, Shall the axe boast itself against him that hews therewith, or shall the saw magnify itself against him that shakes it? As if the rod should shake itself against them that lift it up, or as if the staff should lift up itself, as if it were no wood. And then he says he is going to send great punishment upon Assyria, so that, verse 19, the rest of the trees of his forest may be so few that a child could write them. Chapter 11, account a prophecy about Jesus Christ. There shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots, and the Spirit of the Eternal shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, of counsel and might, of knowledge and fear of the Eternal. Verse 4, With righteousness shall he judge the poor, and reprove with equity for the meek of the earth, and shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked. That's reference to the second coming of Christ. And righteousness shall be the girdle of his loins, and faithfulness the girdle of his reins. Verse 6, 7, 8, and 9 describe conditions to obtain upon the earth during the beginning of the millennial reign of Jesus Christ. Brethren, what is the time setting of this prophecy? What does this page of the sacred Word of God before which we are to tremble tell you? What is it telling you? It is telling you of conditions which shall become extant at the beginning of the millennium, when Christ has in fact slain wicked nations by his own command. In that day, that same day, verse 10, there shall be a root of Jesse, Christ, which shall stand for an ensign of the people, like a banner, like a rallying flag. To it shall the Gentiles seek, the Goyim, the nations of the world, and his rest, the millennial rest, shall be glorious. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria. Where is Assyria? Go and pick up the Hammond Atlas. Go pick up the Reader's Digest or any of the other great atlases. Go look at the great encyclopedic atlases, at the cartographers scrambling around to try to change the borders as they shift so rapidly in Russia and Europe and all over the world, and where only 14 nations within about 1 year and a half became 23 nations. And search throughout the entire world and find for me the nation of Assyria. It isn't there. You can't find it because the Assyrians were driven out by the Babylonians long, long ago. And they were the Chatti. And Chatti devolved into Hessia. And the Hessians actually helped in one of America's wars in a revolutionary period. And one of the chief tribes, you can read my article on Germany and prophecy, had to do with the Halmanni, and the Latin or the Spanish word for Germany is Aleman. The peoples who migrated, oftentimes intermingled with and together with their former captives along the river confluences and valleys into Central Europe and on up into Scandinavia, to Britain, and to the plains in Germany, were Assyrians. He will recover the second time the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria and from Patros, Egypt, and Patros from Cush and Elam, that's Put and Cush, from Shinar and Hamath, and from the coastlands or the islands of the sea. He shall set up an ensign for the nations, and shall assemble the outcasts of Israel, and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. Notice Israel and then Judah. They are not synonymous, they are different. The envy also of Ephraim shall depart, and the adversaries of Judah shall be cut off. Ephraim shall not envy Judah, and Judah shall not vex Ephraim. If you were to study the days of the Palmach, and the Haganah, and the Irgun, and the British forts, and the British who actually kept the wretched refugees who were striving to get to Israel following World War II, and many thousands of them died in the doing of it, in southern France, in Bordeaux, in ports in Italy, at sea, and on board vessels once they were within the sight of Haifa Harbor, where the British kept them offshore. A famous movie many, many years ago in the 1950s called Exodus detailed much of that. The British and the Israeli government are not that close. Ephraim has vexed and has been envious of Judah, and Judah has vexed Ephraim. They shall fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines toward the west. Philistia, Philistine, gave its name to Palestine. And the Philistines and the Palestinians are one and the same people today. And they were the people against whom David had to wage war continually. They shall spoil them of the east together. They shall lay their hand upon Edom and Moab, who is not destroyed when the king of the north comes into the area of Palestine, as it says in Daniel 11, 40-45. The children of Ammon shall obey them, and the Eternal shall utterly destroy the tongue of the Egyptian sea, and with his mighty wind shall he shake his hand over the river and smite it in the seven streams, that's the Nile Delta, and make men walk over it dry shod. And there shall be an highway for the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria, like as it was to Israel in the day that he came up out of the land of Egypt. That has never happened in all of history. This is a prophecy about the time of the second coming of Christ. Where are the people who are identified as Israel? In every biblical prophecy, I will now turn to the 14th chapter of the book of Isaiah, where you read of the condition of Israel at or near the time of the second coming of Christ. They are in captivity, perhaps only one-third or less of them remaining alive, and they have been scattered in nations all over the earth, and I'm sure many of them are still dwelling in the land where so many of their fellow countrymen died. I can imagine the scene when some wretched village in Egypt in the future, maybe less than 20 years hence, we'll say, oh, quick, let's go down to the railway station. They're shipping in another group of American slaves. Let's go down and get us some housekeepers. I need somebody to help in the fields. And here they will come, the able-bodied, the young, the healthy, who were put in the cattle cars in the holds of ships and were taken and sent all over the world. Because it says in the fifth chapter of Ezekiel that Almighty God is going to cause one-third of the nations of Israel to perish through disease and famine and malnutrition, one-third in warfare, and that the remaining one-third are to be scattered among all nations of this earth. Here is a prophecy in the 14th chapter, verse 24. The Eternal of Hosts has sworn, saying, "Surely as I have thought, so shall it come to pass. As I have proposed, so shall it stand. That I will break the Assyrian in my land." I challenge you, get any biblical history book you can ever find and try to explain how, why, when, and where Almighty God completely destroyed Assyria in the land of Palestine. When Babylon superseded Assyria, and Assyria was very successful in its successive waves of invasion and took away tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Israelites, mingled with a few of the Jews, and carried them into captivity to a place called Habor, which I think is nothing more than Heber or Hebrew, and the river today, called in the Arabic Kabur, is merely a derivation of that same term, because it was where they put the Ebers or the Hebrews and left them there. "I will break the Assyrian in my land. Upon my mountains tread him underfoot. Then shall his yoke depart from off them, and his burden from off their shoulders." If you will turn now to Jeremiah, the 30th chapter, Jeremiah 30, those who were in the prophecy class will remember reading a little bit of this. Verse 7, "Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it." In Daniel 12 and verse 1 and 2, it talks about a time that is not ever superseded, a time that is without parallel in the history of the world. In Matthew 24, 21 and 22, "There shall be great tribulation, such as was not since there was a nation, to this time, nor ever indeed shall be." It is all speaking of the same time. "Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it. It is even the time of Jacob's," and Jacob was changed to Israel, "Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it." That's not from it. It is through it, in spite of it, as a result of it. "It shall come to pass in that day, says the Eternal of Hosts, that I will break his yoke from off your neck and will burst your bonds, and strangers shall no more serve themselves of him." It is very, very painful for me, as a boy who grew up in Oregon, as a man who went into the military service of this country and was very proud to do so, and who wore the uniform of my country very proudly for 4 years and participated in the Korean War, to know what I read and what I learned through all of World War II, to have been offshore safe while I learned what my buddies and other people were going through over in Korea, and to know what was happening in that war, to even begin to imagine what awaits the United States of America when we sink into an economic abyss which is going to make our cities and towns look like the streets of Bangladesh, when we in our cities of Chicago and Dallas-Fort Worth will look like the refuse and the trash that you see piled in those wretched streets of Mogadishu, when our cities will look like those like Sarajevo, bombed out rubble with people going to one bursting water pipe to get water, and where, as it says in the Word of God, "They that were brought up in scarlet shall embrace dunghills." No wonder when Jeremiah saw this in vision, he said, my bowels, it hurts me. And he says, "Mine eye runneth down with tears all the day long for the terrible plight of the daughter of my people." He said, "I am turned black. I can't stand it as I see the women and the little children begging for food in the streets and gathering firewood to try to start a fire to boil the water to purify it." And if you read the book of Lamentations and many of the complaints of Jeremiah when he saw what God had promised, if God's people would not repent and turn to him, it made Jeremiah weep in a frenzy of anguish and made him double over, as he said, as if a woman in travail. "Strangers shall no more serve themselves of him." You cannot imagine middle class and upper class American families, men and women, veterans of World War II, of the Korean War, people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s of all different ages, serving third world families, doing housework, farm work, forced labor in factories, and actually working in nations all over Europe, North Africa, in the Middle East, and in Japan, and foreign countries. "But they shall serve the Eternal their God, and David their king, whom I will raise up unto them." What is the time setting? Don't dodge it. Don't rationalize it away. Don't pretend it isn't there. And if you don't think the United States is part of Israel, let me ask you a question. Since there are more Jews in New York City than there are in Israel, and since the twin national fortunes of the nation of modern-day Israel and the United States are so inextricably interwoven, since we are virtually their mentor, do you think for one instant, given what happened and the satellite communication that was given to Richard Nixon during the day when Israel was about to nuclear bomb Damascus and Cairo in the Yom Kippur War, that if Judah is to be completely obliterated, that the United States could stand on the sidelines? Who do you think controls our media? Who do you think controls our banking and financial industry? Who do you think controls the information media, which I already said, but Hollywood and entertainment of the United States? Who do you think in so many areas of the United States has a tremendous amount of influence? Jews. Many of them Zionists. And all of them certainly have a tremendous place in their heart for the little nation of Israel. So don't rationalize this, don't dodge it, don't justify it, don't say this can't mean us, it can't mean the United States. Don't deny what your eyes tell you about the time setting of these prophecies, because it is at the time of the second coming of Christ, the time of the resurrection, where David is to be raised up to become the king over Israel. Fear not, O my servant Jacob, says the Eternal, neither be dismayed, O Israel, for lo, I will save thee from afar. Where is there a nation on the face of this earth where a single Jew is held in captivity today? Where is there one? Where is there a camp for Jews today? There isn't, is there? Then when does this take place? Well, you know what your eyes are telling you. It takes place right at that very time of terrible extremists called the tribulation, the heavenly signs, and the day of the Lord, and the second coming of Jesus Christ. Lo, I will save thee from afar, and thy seed from the land of their captivity. And Jacob shall return, and shall be in rest, and be quiet, and none shall make him afraid. For I am with thee, says the Eternal, to save thee, though I make a full end of all nations whither I have scattered thee, as we read in Isaiah 10. Yet will I not make a full end of thee, but I will correct thee in measure, and will not leave thee altogether unpunished. And what will the mincing sodomites say in that day? And what will the parading dykes on bikes say in that day? And what will all of those who scream for their rights say in that day? What will the dregs of degradation in our society say before God in that day? The United States has been for these several years convulsing, imploding inwardly upon ourselves in an absolute death dance of crime, of pornography, of divorce, of abandonment, of child abuse and molestation, of mental problems. Every tenth American is functionally unable to really, I should say, certifiable in one sense, and not able to function in society normally because of what's going on in their upper story, because of the ingestion of all kinds of substances. There is a gun in every other home in America. There is a gun in every other home in America. This nation is going to fulfill a prophecy, like a prophecy written by a man named Wiley many years ago, who talked about what would happen when government breaks down. Your tribulation may happen in your community, or even in a neighborhood in your community, where eventually Americans are going to turn upon Americans, and Britons upon Britons, and various other groups, minorities, and so on, as we have seen from 1965 in the riots during the Vietnam War, as we saw in Watts way back in the 60s, as we saw recently in Los Angeles and in other cities, where it takes the least excuse, including not a loss, but a win of a professional sports team and our spoiled modern Romans to go out on the rampage and use it as an excuse for a drunken debauch and a complete civic orgy. Americans want an orgy? God is going to give them one. And I'm telling you that God has, apparently, unless he is going to give us the time to go large enough to get the job done, allowed the power of the holy people to be scattered. He has allowed the wicked to do wickedly, and there are the wise that understand, but there are those whom I used to think were wise, who knew There were people who sat in audiences like this one all through the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and heard very similar sermons. And there were men who stood in those pulpits and gave similar sermons, who will no longer preach from those prophecies I just read to you, who will no longer admit that God means us in the United States of America, and they will not write about it, and they won't preach about it, they will not get on television and talk about it, they will not warn this nation. Has the nation had all the warning it's ever going to get? That's a question to me. So as I see that vast Mississippi flooding the entire central part of the United States of America, and the terrible, devastating blow it is to an economy that thought it was just barely beginning to recover, when I see the teeming third world refugees trying to flood into our nation, when I see all the things happening in crime and the absolute joke of our criminal justice system, of murderers going free, when I see it all, as you do, on a weekly basis in your television news, in your newspapers, in the news magazines that I held up and showed you, I have to ask myself, does it begin this way? Is this the way it begins? Does it begin a little here and a little there and a little the other place? Until finally I look back and I realize why the Great Tribulation began years ago.